Today's episode is brought to you by Cars.com. With over 2 million vehicles and 50,000 more added every day, Cars.com will match you with the perfect car for you, your budget, your life, your style. And if you're ready to say goodbye to your current car, Cars.com will get you an instant offer to cash it in. Just start by entering your license plate and get matched with a local dealer who will write you the check. So whether you're looking to buy or sell, just go to Cars.com. It's magical.
Jordan is on best. Harper's on Miller.
They play together, they believe. And Caris LeVert is cold.
LeVert, back in. Speed.
Oh, he's a one-man wrecking crew.
Holiday, shot clock down to six. Finds Warren.
Welcome to another edition of the Indy Cornrows Podcast. This is your host, Mark Schindler. As always, before we get started today, if you have not already, please be sure to rate and review us over on Apple Podcasts. We always want to hear from you and get your feedback. And of course, read us over at IndyCornrows.com. We have a lot kicking now that the season is getting closer to underway, less than 50 days until it is upon us, which is still kind of wild to say. I am really psyched today to be joined by two friends of mine and two really great podcasters and just people in general, Brian Toporek and Morten Jensen from over at the NBA Pod. I'll start with you, Brian. How are you doing this morning, man?
I'm doing well, Mark. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys taking the time. Mort, how are you doing, man, over in Denmark?
Doing very, very well. It is definitely not the morning, but that is okay.
You know, just like in America, we compare everything to what we're doing instead of looking at what anybody else is doing. So it's only fair. I'm really stoked to have you guys on, A, because, I mean, you're one of the few people, I can't English this morning. You guys actually talk about the Indiana Pacers on your pod, which is more than you can say about most national outlets. And I know you guys both are relatively high on them compared to where I think the national set is. I've been trying to parse through where I'm at in terms of observing the league and where they're at as a team right now. Obviously, they're in a state of upheaval compared to where they've been the last couple of years is definitely a fair statement. I think I just want to ask first and foremost, in looking around the league, and looking at this team right now, I mean, what is your general feeling coming into the year, based on the changes or sort of lack thereof that came this offseason? Most of the changes obviously were internal, with coaching and whatnot, but, I mean, how are you feeling about the state of the roster right now in general? I'll start with you, Mort.
No, I like the roster. I don't know where to place it when it comes to like league-wide territory, because I think so many teams made, yeah, right? I mean, so many teams made such drastic changes that I think we kind of need to get into the regular season and let things calm down a little bit before we really understand like what are the truly great teams, what teams are going to be disappointing, all of that. But so I kind of pivot back to just the quality of the roster and the talent level, which I think is substantial. And I have no clue whatsoever why the national media is not picking up on that. I think the evolution of O'Shea last year was huge. I mean, you essentially got someone in who is a pseudo starter or at the worst thing, maybe a seventh man, who is still young enough to get better over the next 3 or 4 years. And somehow that was glossed over. I don't understand that. You know, we have TJ Warren coming back. Caris LeVert is fortunately healthy. He should be back and fully ready to go. You still have that little weird lockjam up front, of course, with Sabonis and Miles Turner. But still, I mean, those two in their own ways are just tremendous. Like, you have one of the best defensive interior players in Turner, of course, and then you just have Jokic East in Sabonis, really. And you could argue, do the pieces fit optimally? Probably not, but just having that level of talent to go off of in the first place and then making changes from that is a hell of a good place to be compared to other franchises that don't even have that talent level.
Yeah, and then, I mean, Brian, I'm assuming you're kind of coming from the same place with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, sports in general are like a what have you done for me lately kind of league. Yep. And the Pacers last year through the Bjorkgren disaster, especially.
It didn't happen as far as I'm concerned. That year of my life, you know, 2020 didn't happen. So, fine.
Yeah, it's probably for the best to just flush that out. That's what I did to the 2019 26ers. It just didn't happen. But, yeah. I mean, they are an example of how, you know, you can turn things around very quickly. I think the upgrade to Rick Carlisle is going to be huge for them. It's just health for this team, right? We haven't seen this starting lineup, or like the Pacers starting lineup in general, healthy in now 2 years. So if these guys, if you can have Brogdon, LeVert, Warren, Turner, Sabonis stay healthy, you know, I think these guys are a threat to Milwaukee and Brooklyn in the East? No, I don't. You know, I put them probably a tier below. I think Miami's going to be in that top four mix. We'll see what happens with Philly. No one knows what to do with them right now until they resolve the Ben Simmons situation. You know, I think Atlanta.
I heard tweeting works.
I think Atlanta coming off the Eastern Conference Finals run, they didn't lose anyone of real consequence this offseason. So I think they deserve the benefit of the doubt. But, you know, I don't see why the Pacers can't be in the mix with, you know, Chicago,
New York.
Yeah. Hornets, I think, are going to be probably in that. You know, I think these are all like play in caliber teams. Mm-hmm. The Wizards, I think, you know, potentially got a lot better this offseason. So I think the Pacers are probably going to be in the play in tournament. Like, I think the sixth seed is probably their ceiling, but I also don't think. I'm not like writing them off completely coming into this season. Like Orlando, I'm out. Detroit, I'm out. Cleveland, I'm pretty out. So like right there, those three teams, you know, are 13, 14, 15. You only have like two other spots that you need to jump over to get in the play-in tournament. So I think that's going to give fans a lot of hope in general, not just of Pacers fans, but around the league. Like it's not that hard to get into the play-in tournament anymore. And that all you have to do is win one or two games and you're in the playoffs at that point.
I probably have the Pacers a little bit over the Wizards, though, Brian.
I might just be higher on the Wizards in general because of, you know, I think trading Russ for all of that depth. Mm. I don't know. We'll see. I don't feel strongly one way or the other. I don't have any major strong convictions about it. And like same with Charlotte. I mean, I don't know, you know, how I rank those three teams. I have no idea. It comes down to injuries, honestly.
Yeah, well, let's parse through the East because that's one of the reasons I want to bring you guys on today, because that's where I'm trying to get is thinking, okay, well, where do I think this team falls out? Like you mentioned, like I think it's entirely possible that they could become a higher seed, but it's also like if they are a play-in team again, you know, I'm not really that surprised. Like anything could happen this year. A lot feels like banking on health and internal development in some ways, and we can talk more on that later, but like I think you look at it, and ultimately, like you're mentioning, like I think Charlotte, I don't want to say, saying that they're slept on feels like a ball don't stop kind of thing to say, but like it's just true. Like Charlotte, okay, I don't think that they're necessarily a playoff team, but just looking at last year, they were the four seed until Gordon Hayward got hurt, and then they were still hanging on until LaMelo missed a month. Like they were a very solid team last year. They did get better, as much as people are going to say, well, oh, they traded for Mason Plumlee. Well, they were starting Bismack Biyombo for half the year last year. And he was probably the worst center who played 20 minutes per game in the NBA. Like, I love Biz, but, like, he can't catch a basketball. Like, it's just – I'm sorry. Like, that is what it is. Like, adding – as much as people are going to, again, clown Kelly Oubre, like, Kelly Oubre is still a solid player. You add him to a rotation that could use more solid players. I think that there's a real chance Charlotte is still a very competitive team next year. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what to make of Toronto. Mm-hmm. Where are you guys at with the Raptors? Because for me, like I look at that team and it's like, well, all this stuff happened about potentially trading Pascal. And this roster just feels like very kind of torn in two directions in some ways. And it feels like they're ripe to make some kind of move. If they do, as you know, it depends, but regardless, it's kind of in a weird spot and very different from where they've been the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a lot about the Raptors going into this offseason because I think it was such an interesting situation they found themselves in. They could have pivoted both to becoming even more win now as they were a couple of years ago, or they could pivot into being a complete rebuilding team because they have Pascal. They could also flip to over Fred VanVleet if they wanted to. But it seems like they're going with the Boston Celtics model of, well, we are going to develop young guys. Like we're going ahead with, you know, Gary Trent Jr. Oh my God, I'm totally blanking on the rookie right now.
Scotty Barnes.
There we go. Scotty Barnes. Wow. See, I'm just coming off work. So my
it's
head
been
is
a very elsewhere. Long off season.
Yeah. Yes. But I mean, they're going with you know that model of we are going to try to be competitive while we develop a bunch of players, which okay. I mean, I don't personally I see a lot of teams are doing that, and I don't really know whether that's justified because it didn't really work in Boston, but somehow it's a way like teams to be copying that mentality. Like, okay. But like overall, I think they're a pretty good example of the East overall getting better because they, again, they still have Pascal Siakam. They still have Fred VanVleet. Garrett Trent Jr. is really good. I mean, Scottie Barnes is going to be really good. They have a lot of talent, and we are sitting here going, do they even make the playoffs? Are they even going to be in the play-in? Like the Eastern Conference right now is loaded, which also just puts Indiana's situation in sort of an interesting perspective, right? Because where do they go? Like they have a lot of talent, but given the strengthening of the East, where does that put them? So yeah, it's such a hard question, such a tough question to try to figure out like where did these all land. I really think we don't know jack shit until we're like 25, 30 games into the season.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are only three teams, honestly, two teams, Detroit and Orlando are the only two teams going into the year in the rebuilding mindset. Cleveland, right. I don't think is. I don't think they're going to make the play-in.
Well, they will be.
But, I mean, you know, they are at least convinced, especially with this marketing acquisition. Like, sure. They clearly want to take a step forward. I don't think they have the talent to do so yet. But you can make a case the other 12 teams in the East are all going into the season at least saying we could be in the play-in tournament. Mm. We have a chance to make it. And two teams are going to end up disappointed in that mix. Toronto, for me, I think it's a question of their depth more than anything else. Like, I really like how they're starting 5 fifths together with VanVleet, Gary Trent, OG Anunoby, Siakam. Kem Birch played well for them after he came over late last year. You have Chris Boucher off the bench. We'll see what happens with Goran Dragic, but if they don't trade him right away, or if he actually shows up and contributes, he could be a nice piece. You know, Malachi Flynn, Precious Achiuwa. So they have talent, but after that, there is a drop-off, especially if Goran doesn't play for them or leaves by the trade deadline. You know, it gets thin quickly. So if they have one or two injuries, that's where, I mean, we saw it last year, that's where they could really fall apart. I think I'd put the Pacers above them because of the depth concerns right now. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see the Raptors as the 10 seed once the season concludes. It's just, I think you said it well, Mark, they're a team where I'm waiting to see what happens both with, you know, with Dragic, because he very much made it clear he wants to go to Dallas. And then, you know, they keep popping up in these Ben Simmons trade rumors as well, which I don't entirely understand. Like, maybe that's more of a three-team construct than just Simmons going to the Raptors, but we'll see how that would affect, I mean, regardless of whether it's a two-team deal, three-team deal, if they work their way into that trade, that could just totally change their perspective this year as well.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And we'll talk about Ben a little bit later, because I did have questions about him. So we do have a lot to talk about with that. Well, you mentioned the Wizards, and I think this is a great point too. Like, I understand it's really difficult to talk about Russ sometimes, because I think there's got to be a lot of nuance with it. Like, looking at Russ last year was obviously a tale of two seasons, and you can kind of say that about his last 2 years. Obviously, the back end of last year was fantastic. He looked like an all-NBA player. The first 35 games, no. Like, I mean, it was very clearly a minus for the Wizards. A lot of that is due to injury, but just frankly, that's what happened. But now you add in Spencer Dinwiddie. I don't know what to expect from him coming back from a pretty significant injury, but also we've seen guys come back from that. I expect Spencer to be solid. He's a better defender than Russ at this stage, just to be completely honest. Like, he's going to be more.
Well, you are too, Mark.
Well, yes, that is a fair way to put it. But I do think, like, all around, I think Spencer makes a little bit more sense with Bradley Beal. Like you mentioned, the depth is fantastic. Like, because of, you know, how we tend to think about the NBA, the first thing that I thought of when the Russ trade happened was, wow, I wonder how this Russ fit works. More like, how are they replacing Kentavious Caldwell-Pope? I think that was a great addition for Washington. I do think, like, you add in somebody like Montrezl Harrell, who Again, I think people get way too caught up in what he struggles with in the playoffs. Like, he's a fantastic regular season player. I think we kind of underrate how important it is to have innings eaters off the bench who can be a positive out there. Montrez does that. Daniel Gafford is back. Like, I think this team is deeper. They're going to be better. Maybe they don't have the same ceiling as a playoff team. I think as a regular season team, if you're getting the same Bradley Beal as last year with maybe some improvements on defense, like, I do think that's still a really solid team that's obviously gunning for the playoffs. They're based on the moves that they're making, they're not trying to be a lottery team. If you have Bradley Beal and you're trying to be a lottery team, then you're doing it wrong. Obviously, Washington did do it wrong for a while, but that's another thing. But I mean, this team's going to be solid still.
Yeah, it feels like there's another shoe to drop with them too, just because they are so lopsided in like wings, forwards, and centers. And like, I mean, you've got Dinwiddie and Beal as a starting backcourt. You have KCP as well. But after that, like Aaron Holiday, who I like, he can be the backup guard. But like, are we playing Kyle Kuzma at the two at some point this year? I mean, you know, you've got the two, Hachimura, you have Denny, you have Davis Bertans, you have Gafford and Bryant, you have Kuzma, you have Montrez. It just feels like they're due to trade one of those guys for more of a 2-3 type. And if they can do that, I feel a lot better about their chances. You know, again, I put them probably in the lower end of the teams that are going into the season hoping to make it to the play-in tournament. Like, I think they end up in that 9, 10, 11, 12 mix. I don't see them as a real threat for a top six seed at all.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, looking ahead, Bradley Beal was going to be one of the most popular names to come up over the next year with trade speculation. I think the moves that they made this summer, I don't know if it's enough to convince him to stay long-term, but I think they definitely increased their chances of keeping him around. And it wouldn't totally shock me if we get to October, then we hear that Bradley Beal is signing, you know, maybe it's not a 5-year extension, but maybe he does like another 1 or 2 year deal. Cause he says, okay, you guys actually, we looked like we were dead in the water after that playoff loss, and we have Russ for 2 more years. And like, now all of a sudden we have depth, we have flexibility. This is great.
And we have Giannis apparently.
Oh God. Giannis 2.0.
Giannis 2.0, right?
Don't remind me. Yes, any international player with a semi-long last name is Giannis 2.0. How could I forget? I actually do like Rui. I am a Rui guy, to be honest. Yeah. I think he improved a lot last year. But like you mentioned, like they have they're a very oddly constructed team right now. Like, I think they have a lot more flexibility than they did last year, obviously. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of moves they make, because they have guys that would be very interesting to other teams as well. So you look at it and say, okay, well, we'll see where it goes. I feel pretty positive about the Wizards for the first time in a while. Like, I think Tommy Shepard's done a pretty good job of rearranging things. I still am never going to forgive Scott Brooks for destroying Isak Bonga and Troy Brown Jr., but, you know, that's, again, another discussion. Well, let's move on. I think the Chicago Bulls are very similar to the Pacers, I think, other than the Pacers. They're the team that I have no idea where to place in this coming year. I think I've found myself a lot higher on them than other people. Because especially like looking at the way that we're talking about teams, I understand. I think we have to sometimes separate playoff viability and where a team's going to finish in the regular season. Because, well, okay, you can look at it and say, well, you know, this team is probably, maybe they don't win a second round series, but I do think you could see them being a top 4 or 5 seed in some ways. Like, I think that's very possible with the Bulls. And I understand there are real concerns about their defense. I think they've been sort of overblown. Like, I get it. DeMar is a very bad defender. I think Vooch is a better defender than he gets credit for. And I also think Billy Donovan's going to put them in better situations than people are making it out to be. Like, I think you can look at it and say, oh, well, you know, they're going to get absolutely destroyed in pick and roll. Well, also, they're going to do things to make it so that's not happening all the time. Like, it's a two-way battle. And also, you're not, I mean, during the regular season, unless you're having some more of the back-to-backs like we saw this past year, you're not seeing the same kind of tactical strategic battles that are going to happen in the playoffs that are going to really nitpick and degrade some of the issues that a team could have defensively. So like, I don't think they're going to be an above average defense, but I think if they're like 16th or 17th in defense, that would not surprise me at all. I think that they have enough surrounding pieces And a lot of it's just going to come down to coaching for me. But I look at that offense and I think, okay, you have the best driver that Zach LaVine's ever played with, and probably the best facilitator passer that he's ever played with, because DeMar is a better passer at this stage than Jimmy Butler was. Jimmy Butler never played with Zach. They traded for each other. Point being, like, yeah, there's right. Zach has never played with a passer the level of DeMar. Adding that in on top of everything Vooch can do as a post facilitator, popper, especially, like, I just think that we have overthought the Bulls in some ways, especially in terms of looking at the contract, like, whatever, you know, DeMar got paid a lot of money, but he's a good player and the Bulls are trying to be good right now. So I think maybe it comes off a little reductive the way that I talk about the Bulls, but I also think we just kind of have to realize, okay, good players are good. This team should be pretty good next year. Like, where are you guys at with the Bulls right now?
Oh, absolutely agree with you on that. Look, this is a team that trotted out Denzel Valentine, Ryan Arcidiacono, and Cristiano Felicio last year. And people are like, oh, well, you overpaid DeMar DeRozan. Like, are you kidding me? Yeah. Like, when you replace the minutes of those, that trio of abomination with DeMar DeRozan and Alex Caruso and all these new players, like, you are going to get better. You kind of said it yourself with Zach. Like, he's never played with this much playmaking before. There are actually multiple layers to this. So DeMar has never played with the same level of spacing before. Vucevic has never played with the same level of talent before. This has a potential to be one of the most explosive offenses in the entire NBA. And for Zach specifically, he played with, you know, Tomas Satoransky and Kobe White as his point guards last season. And yet he was one of the most effective off-ball players in the entire NBA. Imagine what he'll do now that he has competent passers alongside him. Yet for some reason, and I won't mention any names that work for The Athletic, it's all about this negative hive mind of, oh, Zach LaVine is an all stats guy and nothing else, which if you are of that opinion still, then you haven't watched him play for 2 years. And I don't, I won't attack anyone for not having watched the Bulls a lot over the past half decade, because they have been both boring and bad. But LaVine is good, and you add good players to him. So obviously, like you said, Mark, you need to simplify and just go, there is talent now. This isn't entirely dissimilar to the Pacers, where you just need to get in quality players and then you'll figure it out from there. Chicago's roster 2 years from now isn't locked into being the same roster that it is right now necessarily. Right now, they just need to get back into relevance. And you know what? Everyone is talking about them, but per definition, they're relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like what Atlanta did last offseason, where this was your last chance to really go out and spend like this, because LaVine's up for this max deal that next summer. So you either use it or you lose it. And you bring in so many upgrades in Ball, DeRozan, Caruso. Now you're starting five of Ball, LaVine, DeRozan, Patrick Williams, and Vooch. And then you still have Caruso, Kobe White, Troy Brown Jr. You just got Derek Jones Jr., Tony Bradley off the bench. Like, that's a legit 10-man rotation. I mean, it's just a lot of talent there. And it's,
and Millsap, maybe.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're still going after Millsap. I mean, it sounds like he has a number of suitors, so I'm not sure that they're going to actually get him. But, you know, that it's a good reminder that they aren't necessarily a finished product as is. But even if they are, I feel very confident in their top 10. And there aren't a ton of teams that I can say that about. So, yeah, I mean, I'm with you guys. I think, you know, I would be surprised if the Bulls finish outside the top eight. I think they have a real shot at a top six seed. And then, Mark, you said it well. I mean, do I think they're going to make it to the Eastern Conference Finals this year? Probably not, you know, barring a Hawks-esque run. But, worry about the playoffs when we get to the playoffs. So we're focused on the regular season here, and I think they're going to be a very good regular season team.
Yeah, exactly. And I think my way of looking at it too, like, I think, especially for a team like the Bulls, you have to get good at some point. Like, you can't just keep being a team over and over again and saying, well, we're going to try and assess where we're at, bring in more talent. Like, Zach LaVine was a borderline top 15 player last year before he had to miss a month with health and safety protocols. Like, I think at some point, like, Arturis Karnišević and Mark Eversley said, okay, we have a player that we are not going to be able to get in the draft. or through trade. So we have to build around him and see what we can do. And I get, like, I understand, but I also, like, I understand why people get frustrated, but I also think, like, it's not championship or bust. Like, you can't just go from being a 28 win team to being a 55 win team that goes to the Eastern Conference Finals. Like, that just doesn't happen very often unless you're, I say that and Atlanta pretty much did that last year, but you know what, it takes an entire set of circumstances for that to happen. The last team that I want to hit on before, actually two teams that I want to hit on before I send you guys a couple quick hitter questions. Boston, I feel better about Boston now. That obviously they had the Dennis Schroeder move came through for them. Some moves that kind of went their way towards the end of the cycle. I still feel like I think Jason Tatum was just about a top 10 player last year. He's going to make even more strides this year, I'd imagine. But I also think that team is pretty flawed in a lot of ways. I really don't trust their big man rotation. I like Robert Williams III. I just don't like, health is such a big question with him. Al Horford, I think I'm higher on Al Horford than general consensus. Like, I thought he was very good when he was with OKC last year. Obviously they were a top 10 defense when he was playing, and then mysteriously he was not playing anymore. Not so mysteriously, I should say, but like, I think he's still more in the stage of being like we've seen with Paul Millsap recently, like playing 20 to 25 minutes per game. He can still start, but if you're relying on him to be this guy who's gluing everything together for you, I don't really know how I feel about that. I mean, how have you felt about Brad Stevens's moves as GM so far, which is still so weird to say in my mind?
I mean, so for those who aren't familiar with the NBA podcast, Brian has made it his personal mission to basically drive away every single Boston fan that could be listening to us, and I hate him for it. But since we're not doing the NBA podcast right now, I'm just going to sacrifice my time and let Brian go in on Boston as an organization, because we can't lose listeners. So go ahead, Brian, knock your socks off.
I've been nice about Boston this offseason. I'm getting it all out of the way now so I can start crapping on them once the season starts.
Oh, of course, but you are. God damn it.
But I mean, I'd be nice on our podcast about them. I'm actually pretty high on what they've done this offseason. I mean, by all accounts, Kemba's knees are just toast. Like, I hope it's not true, and I hope he has a great season with the Knicks, but I don't think the Celtics could go into next season counting on Kemba Walker to stay healthy and be their starting point guard. Like, the guy they signed 2 years ago just does not sound like he's going to come back at any point. So turning him into Horford, who already has chemistry with these guys. And as you said, Mark, he played well in OKC last year. The Philly thing was a disaster because of a bad team fit. I don't think that's going to be the case in Boston. We've seen him play well with the Jays. You know, I think playmaking is the big concern for this team. If Marcus Smart is your starting point guard, and you know, you have Josh Richardson, the Jays, and Horford, you're going to have to lean on a lot of iso ball, I think, from the Jays. And then Horford's going to have to facilitate some, which he can do, but you're not, I don't think anyone on this team is going to average like even 6 assists per game, which is wild to say. Getting Schroeder, I think, is going to be a big lift for them. I think, you know, depth would have been a concern for them otherwise. Peyton Pritchard did play well last year and was way too good for summer league this summer. So I think there is some optimism with him, and then Aaron Nesmith as well. Health for sure is a concern with Robert Williams, but the rotation of him and Cantor backing up Horford, like, I think you can piece together a center rotation between those three guys. So I like Boston. I'm relatively high on them this year, but a lot of that is just faith in, like, Tatum. I agree with you, is, you know, all NBA caliber talent. Brown is an all-star as well. Like, I'm trusting their top end talent to carry them. If either one of those guys goes down, then we're in some trouble.
Yeah.
Where is this diplomacy on our podcast? Where is that?
Nice.
Oh, wow. All right. You know what? I'm not going to sacrifice my time then. Screw you, Brian. Damn it. Wow. All right. No, I actually agree with the very level-headed mind of Brian Zaporic for a change here when it comes to Boston. I think I'm very high on the Robert Williams extension personally. Mm-hmm. I understand the injury concerns. Trust me, I do. But if healthy, and I'm the guy who always looks at the glass half full when it comes to like health issues, especially for young players, assuming you haven't been through, you know, a major career defining injury. So I'm going to be optimistic and say he's probably going to play a little bit more. He's going to be healthier. And he's a guy who can really pass the ball. He's a strong shot blocker. He's one of the most athletic big men in the entire NBA. He also understands when not to take a shot, which honestly I think is such an overlooked thing in basketball, especially for young guys. Like, there's a reason he's shooting 72% from the field. And I realize he's limited in that, like, he's not going to go out and like do, you know, hesitation pull-ups from 15 feet and all that. But for just for him to recognize, yeah, you know what? My bread and butter is right along, like right near the basket. It is lobs. It is cleanups. It is all these kinds of things. That is such a luxury for young players, knowing to play within their roles and star in it. So for that, I think that was a huge, huge get for them to lock them up, or lock him up rather. Then we come to Dennis Schroeder. I would have been nervous about sort of if he had signed anywhere for like the 20 million things that were reported. Mm-hmm. For the Celtics to get him at 5.9, and I know it's just 1 year. Brian, you kind of said it. I mean, having that depth off the bench, someone who can come in and just score, get you 18, 19 points if you need to, that is going to lessen the offensive pressure of the two Jays, which frankly is going to be necessary. Otherwise, the both of them would have to average 30 this year, because looking at that roster, there is not a whole lot of offense on it if you remove Schroeder from the equation. So I think that was huge as well. I think both of those guys are going to improve. I do just overall question where they go from here. What's their next step? This was supposed to be this team that had, you know, Jalen and Jason. They were going to, you know, make additional moves and become the princes of the NBA. And it hasn't happened. Like, I'm just sitting here kind of waiting for what's next. What is the next level that they're trying to get to? Because I don't see that pathway a whole lot.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think that's kind of where I'm at too, because we've looked at everything. And like you mentioned earlier with Boston, like a lot of it has felt like they were trying to bring along Jalen and Jason. And it also felt too like they were expecting more of their picks to work out than did happen. Obviously, I mean, hitting on Jason and Jalen is the best part and the hardest part to make happen. But other than Rob Will, and I mean, obviously, I mean, Case is still, I mean, Peyton Pritchard and Aaron Nesmith had solid years. I don't necessarily know entirely what to expect from them this year. Like, I think Nesmith will be better. I really liked him down the stretch last year. And I actually, like, looking at their construction right now, I wouldn't be shocked if he starts, because you'll need space and you'll need another wing out there. I don't think you can start Josh Richardson personally. I try very hard. I have like way too much Josh Richardson stock still. He was one, like, I mean, his 18, 19 year in Miami was just incredible to watch. Since then, nothing has happened. He hasn't played for 2 years, as far as I'm concerned.
He's better conceptually than he is.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
You like view him from afar and you're like, oh wow, this guy is a really good basketball player. And then you watch him every night and you're like, ooh.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's just, I sold my stocks and it feels great just letting you guys
know. Well, I'll keep hoarding them so he can win sixth man of the year this year or something. But I mean, it's hard because like he has to have the ball in his hands to be pretty effective. So like I think you can see like there's talent on the team. I question a little bit how the depth fits and what it looks like around Jason and Jalen, like we've talked about. But they're a team who feels like, okay, is there a move for them this year? Because it feels like there has to be. And I don't necessarily know if I agree with like trying to stockpile everything and wait for Bradley Beal. I don't know if that's, you know, necessarily what they're trying to do. It seems like it in some ways. But like you're mentioning, I think their next step is, okay, who is somebody that can fit alongside them that makes sense? And they're still trying to find that. But regardless, I think they're going to be a playoff team this year. I would have them above the play-in currently just because, again, a lot of it is relying on health, but I think if they are healthy, which again, you can say for every team, I just believe in them as a team overall. They feel deeper than last year, even like if Chris Dunn is 90, 95% of what he was with the Bulls, like he's a rotation player, even if it's an imperfect player. Like I think you're hoping for a Romeo Langford step somewhere this year. He had flashes last year. Like there's something to believe in here with the Celtics. But moving to the last team I want to talk about before we hit on a couple quick things is the Knicks. The Knicks have been very loud on Twitter, that is for sure. or I should say Knicks fans. And I understand it. I love the Knicks fans. Please don't kill me on Twitter. But in looking at where they're at, like, obviously, I think they didn't really solve any of their problems this offseason. But they also got better, in my opinion. Like, they added more depth. I really like the guys that they drafted, even if it's not necessarily like – I liked the guys who they drafted. I don't necessarily love the process behind it. I think that they could have like, going after somebody like Sharif Cooper would have made a lot of sense for them. You could say that, again, about, like, 29 other teams. But I think they saw, okay, well, Julius Randle was really good last year. There's probably going to be some regression this next year because he had just an outlier good year. But I also think some people are making it out like he's going to just go back to being who he was before this year happened, which I would disagree with. But then you look at everything else and say, okay, Evan Fournier is a really good player. You add him. Again, he's not a guy who's going to bend the defense for you, but he can continue plays, he can finish plays, and he's not going to get absolutely murdered on defense. That's a plus. I think definitely a better player than Reggie Bullock at this stage. Not even just at this stage, just in general. Like, you add in more guys who make sense around this team. You take a bet on Kemba Walker, which I think makes sense, especially given the way that things worked out. If he's able to play 50 to 60 games and he's healthy for those, like, I think that's a win. Like, I can just squint and say, okay, this team is going to be good. And I appreciate what they did because I think a lot of people really wanted them to go out and try and do something big and flashy. And to me, I appreciate them staying in the course because that's the opposite that the Knicks have done my entire life. They've made the playoffs, well, including last year, I think twice since I've been able to remember watching basketball. So that's a positive start. Like, I think just saying, okay, we're going to bank on being good, and then we can go from there. Because if you're going to build up some kind of name or brand recognition and, quote unquote, take back the city, you have to actually win and do things in a consistent manner to get there, like we saw with Brooklyn a little bit. Obviously, it's a different scenario, but I feel solid about where the Knicks are at. I don't think they're going to end up the four seed this year, but I do think that – I don't want to say they've been discounted because I think they've been very vocal about it on Twitter. But I do think that they're going to be a solid team again this year.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I was actually one of the people who were on the wagon of, hey, go all out. Like, try to trade for Dame or something along those lines. Like, use your cap space in that manner. Like, try to absorb some sort of guy and then give up a lot of assets and then offer a team, you know, immediate financial flexibility as well as young players and draft picks. So that I came in with significantly higher expectations. So I was a little bit disappointed over the course of the early days, but I kind of pivoted and realized, you know what, you know, sticking with the guys that kind of made you go to the playoffs in the first place last year, that's not a bad thing. And at the same time, you do get Kemba Walker in, even though he's not going to be the same player. It's a very low risk move because you have Emmanuel Quickley waiting in the wings. You have Derrick Rose, who's around as well. You have Luka Vildoza as well. Like, so even if,
and you don't have Elfrid Payton. So
you don't have Elfrid Payton. Yes. Exactly. That's a huge plus in and of itself. And you have Barrett coming into year three, right? I mean, you have these many assets working for you. Fournier, like, that acquisition, man, I love that so much. I think for him to come in and be that tertiary, you know, shooter, floor spacer who can give space to RJ and to Julius, that's huge. Like, who was that guy earlier? Reggie Bullock? Like, sure, but no one really gave him the same gravity as someone like Evan Fournier. There is substantially more offensive potential in Fournier as an individual player. So, no, I really like what the Knicks did. Do I think that they're going to make the Eastern Conference Finals and compete for a championship? No, I don't. I don't. Sorry, Knicks fans. I don't think right now, at least 2 years down the line, maybe we'll see. But they're making these small steps that they should have made 9-10 years ago, where they were so busy every single year, like trading their draft picks, going for someone like established who turned out to not be established. And yeah, so it's just nice to see the Knicks arm themselves with patience, is kind of my point.
This is advertiser content brought to you by Frito-Lay.
Hello, I'm Chip Murphy, here to get you ready for the big tournament. Tonight we break down who will be cutting. Cut! What are you two doing?
Sorry, Chip. Prez here got his feathers ruffled when I told him Ruffles has zero chance of winning the title.
And I was letting Dip know that she is not taking into account Ruffles' iconic ridges.
Guys,
It's March. We have to start talking about the tournament.
We are. It is the 2023 Frito-Lay Snack-It.
We're talking about big-time matchups between Cheetos, Smartfood, Lay's, Sun Chips, and more.
Just head to the Frito-Lay Snack Bracket and vote for your favorite chip, pretzel, or dip for a chance to win up to $1,000 or a year's worth of snacks.
This sounds great. Keep up the good work.
Just go to Frito-LaySnackIt.SBNation.com. No purchase necessary. Sweepstakes ends 4-3-2023. Void where prohibited. Here's worth of snacks awarded in the form of 52 coupons, each good for one bag of chips. See official rules at Frito-LaySnackIt.SBNation.com.
Yeah. I mean, they lost, other than Bullock, they lost no one of real consequence, with all due respect to ceremonial starter Alfred Payton and to Frankie Smokes. But going from Bullock to Fournier and Kemba should at least help their offense not sputter and die like it did against the Hawks in the playoffs. I think those guys are going to take a lot of pressure off of Barrett. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if we see a big year three leap from Barrett, and he's probably going to be in the most improved player conversation, which is going to piss Mort off because he's such a high draft pick. I'm already excited about that.
Ineligible. Ineligible.
I cannot wait until we our first quarter season awards pod in December, when RJ Barrett is leading on all the odds markets for most improved player. But I do think he's probably, because he's going to potentially slide down the hierarchy a little bit, or teams just have to devote more focus to Kemba and to Evan Fournier. It's going to open things up for RJ more. Julius Randle isn't going to have to be, you know, the nonstop focal point of this team offensively. You still have Nerlens Noel and Mitchell Robinson as two great shot blocking bigs. Maybe, I mean, Obi Toppin started to come into his own late last season. Maybe we see him carve out more of a consistent role this year. So I'm with you guys. I think they're a clear, you know, they're in the play-in mix for sure. They're like, I'm not pushing them to 12th in the East or whatever. I still think they're probably a first round out, and this is really just a bet against Kemba making it to April healthy, unfortunately. But hopefully he does, and you know, maybe we get the Knicks Nets first round series that we've been promised for, I feel like, the past decade at this point.
Year four, Kevin Knox is going to turn everything around.
There we go.
Yes. How can we forget? People forget he was a bucket at Summer League. I don't know. Like, I think I agree that they're probably going to be a first round out, but also you never know what's going to happen throughout the year. My biggest thing with them too, I just get frustrated with contracts. And part of the reason I love talking to you guys is because you're in the same boat. Like, you don't always love talking about contracts. I mean, it's fine to talk about them, but like, I'm not a huge fan of some of the pocket watching that can happen on Twitter, like whatever. My biggest thing with looking at them too is it's less about the years. Like, everyone's like, oh, well, you can't give Nerlens Noel 3 years or this or that. I'm like, well, it gives them flexibility to make moves. Like, having mid-tier contracts is one of the most important things for making moves for a star player. They created like five mid-tier contracts this offseason. Yep. That's huge. Like, that's one of the issues that the Pacers have had over the last couple of years. They have a lot of guys on contracts that are $16 to $24 million. It's not that they're harder to move, but it's harder to package them together to make a sort of consolidation move. When you have multiple guys making $8 to $12 million, that's a lot easier to move, especially when they're good players. So I think in some ways we just, you know, you got to take things with a grain of salt and look at them. And this is not me trying to just like push all my own philosophies on everyone else, but I think the Knicks are going to be solid, and we'll see what happens. I do expect a better playoff series this coming year for a lot of people on that team and just the team in general, but we'll see on it. I think they were a really damn good regular season team, and they improved as a regular season team, in my opinion.
And to your point about the mid-tier contracts, Mark, I mean, the Bulls used Alfredo Gamino to get DeMar DeRozan. Like, that's the kind of blueprint that you're talking about there. Having those guys to come in and be able to match salaries is huge, and you're right. It's actually something that I think we've brought it up on our podcast before, actually, regarding the Pacers, where we've been looking at their salary sheet and going, they kind of need something, like one more piece in that $8 to $12 million range, because I think we had a trade pod going or something, and they came up as one of those things. And it's a really good point.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, it's funny because, like, I think you look at that, like, Jeremy Lamb is kind of that guy for the Pacers, but also given his injury and the way things worked out, his contract has been really hard to move based on reporting. So that can transition us to our next part. So I'm going to send some quick hitters at you guys and we'll close out talking about Ben Simmons after. I'm going to say, all right. So questions on internal development, because for me, I look at this roster and a lot of where I think they could be a higher seed team next year. Like, I think you could, to me, I think I put this range out yesterday. I think you could see them being as high as four if everything works out and health goes in their way, both in a positive and negative way. So, like, other teams deal with injuries because that happens, and they're able to stay healthy. Like, you could see that happening if things really gel with Rick Carlisle. If they don't have injuries go their way, if there are some speed bumps, you could say, okay, well, I could see them being in like the 9 to 10 range. That's entirely possible. Part of the reason I'm maybe leaning a little bit higher up on them being a higher seed, A, is because they need to be, which, you know, that's, it's an easy way to hedge your bets. I mean, this team is essentially second round or bust this year, after being a first round and out team for, I mean, since 2014, they haven't made it out of the first round, obviously. So I think that obviously their goal is make the second round and be competitive there. So of course they're trying to make that higher end, because if you're the sixth seed, it's a lot harder to make the second round. So in terms of looking at internal development, my first question I'm going to send you guys away: what do you think about a TJ Warren bump this year? Because I do think it's something that I'm not as high on it happening, because obviously, unfortunately, missed this last year with the stress fracture in his foot. But I do believe that some of the changes that occurred in his game when he was in the bubble were legit. Like, those felt real to me. I think that there's a way to see that transferring over in this next year. And I am still really intrigued to see how the role hierarchies are going to fall out, given how many guys in this team can demand the ball and demand shots and just usage overall. But I do think there's a real opportunity for TJ to take a jump this year. Even if it's not a massive points per game jump, I do think that there's a way, the way in which that usage is coming could change. And that would fundamentally change the Pacers, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I mean, what he did in the bubble was taking ownership. That's something he didn't do before, not necessarily through any fault of his own. I don't think he was in the right role in Phoenix, for example. And I think when he came to the Pacers, there was this acclimation period. And then at the end of the bubble, he was just like, you know what? No. I am too good for this. I need to go out and play in a certain way, because I can do this. I can go out and give you 40. I can go out and give you 35 consistently. So I might as well lean into that, because that's what the Pacers have needed for a long time. They have needed that one guy who basically goes and says, you know what? We need points. I'm going to produce that. He's got that capability. He shot over 40% from a three over his last two seasons, not including the injured season over four games. I'm discounting that entirely. So we're seeing that jump in shooting. We're seeing that jump in mentality. And we're seeing him be as aggressive on the drive as ever. So yeah, I would not be shocked whatsoever if Warren came back this season and had a career year, even if that means it's not raw points per game, as you alluded to, Mark, but just the aggressiveness, maybe the point per minute production instead. I would definitely be very, very willing to say that he's going to come in and have a huge year. Absolutely. The question for me is entirely physical. Like, how does he feel after a year off?
I'm going to channel Mort and say he just needs to take more threes. I mean, he's shot above 40% from three each of the last 2 years. There's no reason he should, you know, he took 4.2 in 2018-19, 3.4 in 2019-20, and we'll throw out last year because there's only a four-game sample size. But, I mean, in the bubble, he also shot about, I think, 50% from three on almost six attempts per game. Like, that's where I think we could see the real uptick in terms of scoring for him, if he's willing to take more of a green light from deep.
Yeah.
But my question, I want to throw this back at you, Mark, because it's nice to finally ask questions about fit issues instead of having to receive questions about clunky fit. Mm-hmm. In the bubble, of course, Sabonis didn't play. So TJ Warren was playing more of the four than he is, you know, when Sabonis and Turner are both healthy, he's going to have to slide down to the three. So do you think, are they going to be able to find enough minutes for him at the four? Do you think it really matters? Like, does it, you know, could he be as effective at the three as he was at the four in the bubble?
Yeah, I think that's such a good question, because I was answering a question on this yesterday on Mailbag Pod, and I think the question was, is he more effective as a three or a four? And to me, he's kind of in that tweener mold, obviously. Like, he's effective in both in some ways. He can defend both. He can play both. I think, and like you mentioned, it's I really like what he can do as a four on offense, because like part of the big reason why he exploded in the bubble a little bit is he started taking more threes and running spread pick and roll because of guys having to go being more aggressively guarded out because of, I mean, he was taking more stuff off the dribble in the bubble than he had the entire season. Just overall forcing him to be guarded farther out. So I think it's more, if he's playing like that and doing that at the three, he's going to get guarded the same way. Obviously it's different if you're playing, like if you're playing with both bigs, that changes the spacing on the floor a little bit, just given that teams don't necessarily defend Miles and Domas as they would regular floor spacing. But I just think a lot of it comes down to, you know, what his shot profile is like and how he's taking it. But I do agree, like getting him more opportunities at the four, like I really want to see him. Like, I think if we're going to see opportunities with him with the ball in his hands, it's going to come in bench lineups, like playing more as the four, getting some opportunities. Maybe you're getting Malcolm off ball more. You're playing with Chris Duarte off the bench, TJ McConnell, like finding ways to get him the ball in unique ways. And that's part of the reason I'm excited, because I think Rick Carlisle is a guy who we know can do that. Like, he is one of the best at making sure guys get the ball in the right scenarios to really maximize what they can do. So that's part of the reason I'm really in on it happening. But I would agree, I think in some ways he makes more sense as a four. And that's part of another thing that's intriguing with this year is like, okay, you look at, I mean, obviously they had O'Shea Brissett for the last 20 games last year, but other than that, without TJ and O'Shea, they really had a bunch of combo guards and small wings, and then Domas, Goga, and Miles. So there was no lineup versatility. And now you look at this coming year and you add in Chris Duarte, who's kind of a 2.5 position player, depending on how you look at it. You have TJ back, who can guard multiple positions, can play offensively at a few positions, and you have O'Shea. And I think you look at this team, and even though the fit isn't perfect, like you can look at it and say through any given night, all 13 players could play. And it's not, again, it's not perfect, but I think you have a lot of ways you can go versatility wise that we didn't see last year, frankly. So I'm excited about that. But ultimately, yes, I think TJ is better served at the four, which is me just, again, hedging, and we're pretending that we don't have to answer the big question in the room. Like, I do think that's going to ultimately be addressed this year, because, you know, based on reporting and the way that the front offices talk, they still view it as an obstacle. I still don't appreciate that they put it out there publicly that it's an obstacle, instead of like trying to be like all gung ho, like, yeah, we have two centers, we're going to play really hard and see how it goes. It's more like, oh, we have two centers, we're going to try and figure it out somehow. Like, you know, obviously the way you present things publicly changes how teams view what you're doing and can alter the trade market a little bit. So we'll see with that. But hopefully that answers your question. That was a long response.
I'll say, I mean, the Sixers last year with Tobias Harris, that's what they did with him, you know, got him going with these like Tobias versus plus bench units, got him at the four. And that's how they, one of the ways that they helped unlock him's having a career year. So I think that is a good thing for the Pacers to try to emulate with Warren. And I finally just figured out, we're on a Pacers podcast, how did I forget to slander Boston in this way? That would have solved the Miles Turner issue if we just did the Gordon Hayward sign and trade a year ago. But
hi, Brian, there you are.
Welcome back. Well, Danny Ainge, I forgot that Danny Ainge is no longer, I faded him from memory, but now I remember.
That's with me. Yeah.
Almost Danny. But I mean, that, you know, I think that would have solved a lot of issues for both teams, honestly. And, you know, hey, instead they got 2 years of Josh Richardson. So good for them.
Very good for them. So moving to my next quick hitter, what do you guys think about a Domantas Sabonis scoring uptick? Because again, it's less about, I guess slightly about raw points per game, but also more about individual self-creation. Because I think there's this idea like Domas was a 20 and 10 guy last year, and everybody, I think there's a general consensus thought that he's kind of a finished product. I would disagree with that. He's, I believe, just turned 24, or he might be a year older than me. I can't remember off the top of my head. Yeah, he just turned 25. So this is going to be year 6 for him. I love playing around with, I don't know if you guys have seen the Darko projections. I love playing around with the Darko projections. And also just looking historically, most bigs, you kind of find out where they're at, especially in the same like higher usage archetype. You find out, are they taking a leap or are they kind of where they're at by year six? Like it, just going back and looking at projections like Brooke Lopez and DeMarcus Cousins are really great examples to look at. It's guys who were primarily low post scorers who had some ball handling chops, or well, Brooke less ball handling, but like more like they have higher feel ability to actually see things through. You find out where they're at and if they're taking another leap at year six. And I think we're going to be at a very interesting cross section for Domas to see, does he become a guy who really is more of an individual scorer? Can he put can he find more ways of self-creation? Because even though he's scoring 20 points per game, a lot of it is not self-created. A lot of it's opportunistic scoring, release valve scoring. He started trying to put together some post moves that were more of a go-to in end of shot clock scenarios last year. But he doesn't really quite have that go-to move, especially when his left hand gets taken away. What are your thoughts on A, how that would change the team, and B, the possibility of that happening this year? Because I'm kind of in on it happening.
I mean, we saw Nikola Jokic go from barely 20 points to 26 last season, obviously winning the MVP. But I think Jokic is a more natural shot creator for himself. Yep. And this is not to say that Sabonis is in any way a bad ball handler, because for someone his size, he's amazing. There's a reason he's averaging almost 7 assists per game. But Jokic is just in a different, he's on a different level.
Oh, I mean, most definitely.
Yeah. So I think that blueprint, you can sort of toss that aside, but at the same time, you also have to figure in, Sabonis is so much better at creating his own shot at that height compared to other players at his position. So maybe he understands, the more experience he has, that, all right, I actually have an opportunity here to up my volume a little bit. Maybe there is this move I can put on this specific guy. Like, it's the intelligence level. I always believe in intelligent players, that they are going to get better. Having this mentality that a 25-year-old has peaked when he has a high basketball IQ is bullshit. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be that guy, but we have so many examples in NBA history of guys who are smart basketball players who never really seem to stop developing in some capacity. When have we ever seen a clever basketball player stop their development at age 25? Like, humor me, because I can't think of one.
Yeah, LeBron James got to Miami and just said, no more development. So,
exactly, right? No, but so because of that, I think that entire notion should be thrown out. Like, of course he's not a done product. He's not even going to be a done product by the time that he's 29, because players who think the game out will always challenge themselves. They will always find new avenues to be effective. Whether that means scoring, though, Mark, that's, I don't know. Like, maybe he pivots into being more of a facilitator and says, you know what, I'll get my 20 points, but I'm getting so smart now that I can see like all these patterns. So maybe instead of going after 25 points, I'm going to go after averaging 8.5 assists. Maybe that's like his mentality. We don't know. But I just, overall, I think there's going to be an uptick in production. Let's just call it production instead of scoring. Mm-hmm. Because he's just too good not to. And then I don't care what Nate Duncan says, by the way.
Well, that makes two of us.
Yeah. I mean, I think Jokic's leap was in part out of necessity, because they had Jamal Murray.
Yeah.
And then Michael Porter Jr., who really started to come into his own last year. But after that, I believe their fourth leading scorer was Will Barton at like 12 points per game. So, part of the withering depth that Mort and I have hammered over the years with Denver put more on the shoulders of their big three last year. I think the Pacers are at the point right now where they don't necessarily need that, because you still have, Brogdon, you have LeVert, you have TJ Warren, all of whom can shoulder a lot of this scoring load. So I don't know that Sabonis will have a Jokic-esque leap, because, I mean,
yeah, he's just not Jokic. I mean, in all fairness, like, he's not, like, right. But also, yeah, like, it's, there's a lot to look at with it for sure.
Yeah. And I think, as Mort said, like, he can make more of an impact elsewhere, even if he doesn't take that leap as a scorer. Like, if he improves, I mean, his playmaking is already great, but if he improves even more in that regard, if he becomes a better 3-point shooter, a better defender, I would say that's honestly more impactful. Becoming more well-rounded would be more impactful for the Pacers' overall trajectory than, you know, him going from 20 to 25 points per game.
Yeah, a three-point shot, like a legit three-point shot at a higher volume, but like 38, 39%. Oh, man. Like, that would unlock so much for him. And that's not – the thing is, I don't even consider him a bad shooter. Like, I don't look at Sabonis and going, oh, like, he shouldn't take threes or anything. I just – I don't know what it is. I just think he might not be comfortable yet at that range or something along those lines. But, like, the mechanics are fine. I would have no issue looking ahead in 2 years and saying, oh, yeah, he's one of the better big man three-point shooters. I think – the tools are there. It's just a matter of implementing them. And by the way, you guys were right. Paul Millsap is not going to sign with Chicago because 30 minutes ago, he signed with the Nets.
Ooh. Are you serious?
Oh, God. Yeah, yeah.
Come on, man. You got to be kidding. Okay, well, I guess never mind. That's East is solved. But I already thought that that's where the best team, but now, like, adding – that's unfair, man. Like,
that's
– not even that, unfair. That's like, that's awesome. I'm going to enjoy watching the Nets, but, like, wow.
God.
I'm kind of surprised that he chose there. But
my pick for the Bucks repeating is looking worse by the day.
Man. Well, all right. So, obviously, I mean, Paul Millsap is a Net. Now that changes things. Here's a quick question I'm going to throw at you guys, because I had someone ask me about this yesterday, and I was looking at it more in a raw sense. Obviously, Ben Simmons, saying that he's available would be an understatement. He made it very clear yesterday. Regardless of any threads from Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons is available and is not going to play in Philadelphia next year by all accounts. I've thought a lot about the idea of him in Indiana. I'm not normally a huge fake trades guy, but I do think that, there has been reported talks between the Pacers and the Sixers about a potential Ben Simmons trade. I believe it was Malcolm Brogdon and a first. Obviously, that didn't go through. I would not take that either if I was Philadelphia. One of the ideas that got floated to me yesterday was Malcolm Brogdon and TJ Warren, who was on an expiring for Ben Simmons, which would work exactly in cap without having to send anything else over. I personally, if I'm the Pacers, would not do that straight up, because that's just hard to replicate the value. But in doing a counter offer, I'll look at it and say, okay, well, if you give me Ben Simmons and Tyrese Maxey, I'll give you those two players and say, like, however many picks you need to make that work. Say it's like three first round picks. I think some people would say maybe that's too steep. I think I look at that and say, well, it's not ideal for either team in some ways. I would say it's ideal for the Pacers, but I also think Philadelphia's not getting anything ideal just given how things are going. Obviously, they want an all-star player back, but I think getting two sub-all-star players who can help you in the half court in ways that Ben has struggled, while also getting enough picks to help you make future moves. Because I think it's less like, I think my friend Jackson Frank, the big flex, like the ultimate, the great, great basketball mind Jackson Frank put out yesterday. Like, I think that the Sixers are going to be more amenable to bringing in draft compensation now to make future moves, because A, they are kind of low on draft picks right now. And also, just given that they're not going to likely get an all-star player back or a similar player to Ben's talent back, they're going to need to make future tweaks with the roster. I know I'm going on and on, but this has a point. But looking at it from the Pacers' perspective, I think it makes sense, because to me, I'm less in on the idea that a team has to quote unquote be, you know, all in or has to be a title contender to warrant keeping them together. But I do think, too, looking at this, you can say, okay, well, Malcolm Brogdon has 2 years left on his deal, including this year. TJ Warren is up for extension. Not up for extension. He already has been, but, like, his deal is expiring. I, of course, am in the camp that they should do everything they can to re-sign TJ Warren, because there are, like, eight players in the NBA who are 6'8" that can score from all three levels and be a plus on defense. But, you know, given the nature of things, not everyone wants to re-sign somebody to the deal that he might get. I look at this and say, as wonky as that fit would be with Ben in Indiana alongside Domas, like, it's hard to picture that. They play make from the same spots. Ben's not necessarily a great driver, but he's obviously a great playmaker. But I think you look at it and say, okay, well, he's 24 years old. or 25. I can't remember off the top of my head. I'm really bad with ages today, but
25, I believe.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think it's close enough, you know. Already a three-time All-Star. He's the best player in that deal. He's locked up long-term. All three of those things make sense for Indiana. And it's a team like you can say, okay, well, we're going to try and fabricate the team around him and Domas and figure that out. Get talent, figure it out later. You probably acknowledge that there's going to be a move for Miles or whoever, whichever big you want to trade in that alongside in a consequential deal after. It's not perfect, but I think you look at it and say, okay, well, this maybe makes us better, like a one step back, two steps forward approach. What do you guys think of that trade? Because I know that I just threw a lot at you, but where are you at with the idea of that, or just the idea of Ben in Indiana in general?
Brian, yeah. This is yours.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't loved the idea of Ben in Indiana unless there is a subsequent move. And I think if you're going to do it, conceptually, I think he fits a lot better with Miles Turner than he does Sabonis. And you know, based on kind of the tenor of Miles Turner trade talks over the last few years, this might be a question for you. Like, why is the league so low on Miles Turner? I feel like
I have no idea. It's crazy to me. Like, not to go off on a giant tangent, but especially last year, I mean, partially I'm biased. Like, I'm not a fan of the team, but obviously I've talked to Miles. I like Miles a lot. Like, I don't really understand why the league is so low on him. Like, he was generally, until this past year, like, he wasn't a positive offensive player, to be completely honest. Like, yes, he does space the floor, but it was more about his decision-making. That really improved last year. Like, that was his best season as a decision-maker, as a cutter. Like, that was the first time where you don't see him stopping to make reads. Like, he's just making them. He's making plays happen instead of pausing. And you put that on top of, like, I thought if he was healthy the entire year, he should have finished second in defensive player of the year and made an all defense team. Unfortunately, he gets injured at the end of the year, so that doesn't happen. But even without statistical production being better last year, I thought it was the best season of his career, and he was a top 50 player pretty easily to me. I don't know why the league is so low on him, to be frank, especially considering, like, he is not a problem in the locker room. By all accounts, just an awesome dude. He's on a relatively team-friendly contract, in my opinion. Yep. I'm not sure why teams are so low on him. It's a little bit vexing to me.
Me too. But my point is, you know, if they're going to have to trade one of these two bigs, and based on the league seemingly not valuing Miles as, you know, it sounds like both of us think they should, you'll get more back for Sabonis. And I think if Turner and Simmons are a better fit anyway, it's kind of two birds, one stone here. So maybe you turn around, flip Sabonis, you know, I don't know where or for what, but, you know, a Simmons-Turner pairing makes a lot of sense to me conceptually. You know, I don't think the Sixers want to give up Tyrese Maxey.
Yeah, no, I definitely not.
If it's for Dame, they'll do it. But, I, you know, for a package like Brogdon and Warren, I would be surprised. I mean, as you said, they can sweeten the deal with some picks and that'll make them change their minds. But they really need a playmaker back in a Ben Simmons trade. Like, that's all of these, you know, hypothetical Ben Simmons trades that I see, the ones that don't include a point guard, I'm just automatically checked out because they just don't have another option on the roster. Like, Tyrese Maxey is their primary backup playmaker. Shake Milton proved last year he is, you know, overexposed in that role. So they need someone back, you know, and Brogdon, I think, could fill that role well. But I don't think they'd want to give up Simmons and Maxey, because then once again, we have Brogdon, and it's like Jaden Springer would be their next best playmaker. Doc Rivers is not going to trust a rookie point guard, as we saw with Maxey last year.
Just put him in a Mike Scott jersey and he'll play 25 minutes.
I think I don't remember the exact specifics of this, but when, like, all of this first started back during the playoffs, we were going through every single team and trying to figure out a Ben Simmons trade and realized there aren't really a lot of teams that can come up with, you know, just two team deals that make sense for both sides. So we started expanding a little bit. We identified Indiana because I think Brogdon would be a good target for Philly.
Correct. Yeah.
I think the framework we came up with, not including picks, you know, they'd have to be included somehow, but it was like Simmons to Portland, CJ McCollum to Indy, And then I think it was Brogdon and Lamb for salary matching purposes back to Philly.
Something along those lines. What we did, you and I had agreed, we would do a YouTube exclusive video for 20 minutes and we ended up recording for 72. And we just went through. I think we even at one point had San Antonio involved as well. Yeah. Like there were just, we were just going through, but the deal we landed on, like the larger framework, I don't remember the entire framework, but what definitely was Malcolm Brogdon going the other way, because he would just be such a tremendous fit with Joel Embiid. And but I do also remember us saying that we didn't want Simmons to end up in Indiana because that didn't really make a whole lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Like they needed another shooter. And you're right, I think it was CJ who eventually ended up in Indiana with something else. But like a framework of that magnitude, I think is interesting nonetheless. Whether the Indiana Pacers would think so, I don't know. And by the way, the fact that you just proposed that the Pacers send away Sabonis over Miles, I mean, do we really need to give Nate Duncan something to celebrate here?
No, we don't. Yeah, it's so... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I think... I'm not saying that as a Sabonis is a bum, this guy's overrated. It's like, I just think if we're talking... If you really want Ben Simmons on this team, you have to build around Ben Simmons. His strengths and weaknesses are such that you cannot... He is not a plug-and-play player who fits with that. Like, Malcolm Brogdon, plug-and-play guy. You could build, you can just throw him on whatever team you have and he will be fine. Ben Simmons, you have to build around. And I don't know that the spacing of a Simmons Sabonis front court would make a ton of sense. Whereas, Miles Turner is a frustrating player because we've been waiting for him to take this, leap as a scorer and like jump to a 20 points per game guy. And it might not ever happen. And that's okay. But, he's content with kind of hanging out on the perimeter and launching threes, whereas Joel Embiid, like, he is better suited, like, he'll take them, but he's so dominant near the basket that you are wasting him if you are just camping him out. That's not the case with Miles Turner. You're not going to run a ton of post-ups for Miles Turner. So offensively, those two guys fit well. And then defensively, I mean, a Simmons-Turner front court.
Oh, yeah. Man, it makes me happy to think about it, that's for sure. I love defense, so it'd be very fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, it might be the best defensive front court in the league. So I think Indiana should be interested.
We'll worry about that in the playoffs.
Indiana should be interested. I just think another shoe would have to drop. It would probably have to be Sabonis. And overall, I mean, it does seem like Simmons trade stuff will escalate in the coming days and weeks. But I think if there was a two-team deal to be had between the Sixers and any team, it would have already been done. So I think it's going to end up being a 3 or 4 team framework.
But isn't the entire issue here the fact that the NBA has changed, right? We talk about how defense and offense no longer is 50-50. Like offense now rules the game. We are seeing that self-creating shot creating players who can create jump shots and create for others. Like that is the ultimate premium here. And defense has been slowly put into the background because you're just realizing consistently elite offense beats elite defense every single time. And for Ben, who doesn't have that skill, that offensive skill where he can go out and break that get guys down off the dribble and hit a step back three or whatever, that means that you put a cap on your offense. Like, sure, you might get the best defense in the league since the 2004 Detroit Pistons, but what the hell is that good for if you top out at like 94 points per game? Because, as we know, Simmons is someone who shrinks the court substantially. It's just so hard for me to gauge the trade value of that. And then we add another complication to it because the Sixers are a win now mode because of Joel Embiid. Ben Simmons is a win now player. So they would want to get a win now player in return, but no team is out there going, yeah, we'll give you our win now player for your win now player because no, we feel comfortable with where we are. So it's a very difficult process. Like normally you would have teams who are trying to pivot to get younger or young teams pivoting to saying, well, let's cash our chips and go in and on win now thing. the Sixers don't have that luxury. They can't pivot to youth right now. That would be such a slap in the face to the entire fan base. And Joel Embiid is there, so you can't do that. You can't really accelerate the timeline because it's already accelerated. What can you accelerate it to? Trading for a bunch of 35-year-olds like the Lakers? No, thank you. So it's such a difficult situation that they're finding themselves in, I think. And I think that is in part why you're struggling to find packages out there.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that makes a ton of sense to me. It's really tough to think about and evaluate too, because I think, I say all this knowing like I don't think the Pacers are going to do any kind of deal that sends out two core players like that just for Ben Simmons back. And I mean that like in the best way. Like, Ben is a great player, and I think he would be the second or best player on this team, regardless of how you look at it. Like, I think you're picking hairs between him and Sabonis. They both have flaws. They're both really good. But given where this team is at, they're not in a state where they, as much as I don't necessarily agree with it, they're not in a state where they want to take one step back, two steps forward, because they brought in Rick Carlisle. They don't really have any intentions of becoming a non-playoff team. Not that I think that they wouldn't be a playoff team or at least a play-in team, but I just don't think that they're in a stage where they want to do that. So I don't know. It's really interesting to look at. And with Philadelphia too, it's so tough because I've played around so much with trying to figure out what works. And to me, like, I think San Antonio has the best package possible. Like, if you're looking at a team that's just going to send a couple of good rotation players back, like, I think that's the team that probably makes the most sense. But also, I have no idea what to make of what San Antonio is doing right now. Like, they're doing the same kind of thing where they're like, well, we're going to see what our young guys do, but also bring in veterans and not be a rebuilding team. And like, it's a very weird roster right now. I like a lot of their guys, but I also just am not sure how to feel about them. And I don't really know what the gauge of their willingness to give anybody up, but yeah, it's such an odd spot. And especially too, like, I find it rich that the Kings don't want to trade Tyrese Halliburton for Ben Simmons, who would be the best player they've had in, you know, forever. Like, another great
don't buy
point,
that
like,
though. I'll just interject. I don't buy that for a second.
Yeah, I hope not. I mean, I hope it's not true. Like, no offense to Tyrese is a really good player, but like, Ben Simmons is as many all-star appearances as the entire organization does since 2004. So like, that, and it's not all about all-star appearances or whatever, but like, I don't know. It's such a weird situation. And to think that we were going to be this, like, a year ago, I was not prepared to be in this situation or think about like where the Sixers were at like this.
Yeah. I actually do think the Kings are being that stubborn and thinking like, oh yeah, we're not going to trade our two best players. I mean, the Timberwolves sound like they are too, right? It's like, they're not even willing to discuss D'Angelo Russell. And like, most Sixers fans are like, we don't want him. We don't even if you offered him, we don't want him. They're like, no. We want your second or third best player, but we won't give up any of our three best players, even though we've missed the playoffs for.
Would you like Jordan McLaughlin?
Yeah, right.
He can get to the paint. Yes.
Malik Beasley will really do it for you. Like, and I like Malik Beasley, but no, I mean, all these bad teams need to realize you are bad for a reason, and maybe you should not continue to build around the same players year after year. Alas, they are bad for a reason. So yeah, I'm with you. I think the Spurs, if there is a two-team deal to be had, I think the Spurs can put together the most compelling package outside of, obviously, Dame and Portland.
But do you think, with just to wrap up the Kings, do you think that is a front office issue, or do you think it's an ownership issue? Because the only way I see this as if that story is real, that Tyrese Halliburton is not on the table, I think this comes back to Vivek Ranadive.
Yeah. First of all, have you guys ever seen the Stauskas video?
Yes.
Yeah.
One of our favorites to reference.
It's so great.
Yes. Yes. One, two, so three. Great. Nick Rooks. Absolutely.
Yeah, God, it's so great. I think the issue with Sacramento is it's clearly not just like, there's so much more going on there that's not just on court stuff. Like, a lot of the reason, and this is not anything like reported, but this is just my inclination. Like, I like Davion Mitchell. I think the reason he went that high is because he wanted to play. He was willing to play in Sacramento. Like, I think to them, it matters a lot to have guys who want to play there, because frankly, there are not a ton of guys who want to go to Sacramento. But also, that's what's so weird about this. Like, Ben literally, like, he did not cross Sacramento off his short list. Like,
right.
And then I don't know. I have no idea what to make of it. Hopefully we'll see more. Like you mentioned, Brian, it seems like we're going to have a real answer to this within a week or two. maybe even sooner, but I don't know. We'll see. Well, guys, I appreciate you taking this much time out of your day to have this pod. This was a really great time. I look forward to doing it again. Is there anything you want to plug? Where can people find you at? Anything exciting coming up this weekend?
You can find us anywhere podcasts are found. The NBA Pod on Twitter. It's called the NBA Podcast. So please follow us there and subscribe, download all that good stuff. You can also find both of our work at Forbes Sports. Mort covers the NBA at large. I do mostly Sixers with some salary cap stuff sprinkled in as well. But yeah, I wrote about the Ben Simmons situation yesterday, and I'm sure I will be writing about it again very soon.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah, and you can also find us on YouTube, where we have the NBA Show, which is basically our podcast split into smaller segments that we, you know, sprinkle out over the course of a week. So people who want a visual medium gets that.
Well, guys, thank you a ton. To everyone listening, I recommend following the NBA Pod and Mort and Brian both as well. They're great guys, and I enjoy talking to them and hearing their basketball takes as well. And most importantly, just have a good rest of your day. Thank you for listening.